From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Poets reveal things about the world, about ourselves, about themselves. But what do you do when you're a confessional poet and you want to keep your privacy? On today's Fresh Air, poet Sharon Olds explains how she handles that dilemma. Also today, a memoir of love and rage. On the day his lover died of AIDS, Paul Monette began writing about their year-long struggle against the disease. Today we speak with Monette about witnessing the ravages of AIDS and about his new book, Borrowed Time. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue of vintage recordings by Viennese conductor Alexander Zemlinsky. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explains why the dictionary is in alphabetical order and the thesaurus isn't. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is poet Sharon Olds. Her second book of poems, The Dead and the Living, won the 1985 National Book Critics Circle Award. In her latest collection, The Gold Cell, many of the poems are about being a daughter, mother, and wife. David Levitt wrote, "Sharon Olds is enormously self-aware. Her poetry is remarkable for its candor, its eroticism, and its power to move." Poet Diane Wachowski said, "What makes me read and admire Olds' poems is an obsession which runs through every poem, destruction. There is not a single poem by Sharon Olds which does not intertwine destruction and creation." Sharon Olds has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Nation, and The New Republic. She's taught at Brandeis, Columbia, and New York University, where she's now the director of creative writing. I spoke with her from the NPR Bureau in New York. I wanted her to read her poem Summer Solstice, which is about someone who almost committed suicide by jumping off a building. But first I wanted to know if the poem was about someone she knew or someone she read about in the newspaper.
It's not always a safe assumption to make in many poets' work that it really happened at all.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But in this case, it did. It was something that happened across the street, right across the street from where I live. So it wasn't someone that I knew, but it wasn't something that I read in a paper. It was something that I watched as it unfolded, hiding.
You were hiding while you watched?
Well, I was hiding behind the corner of my shutter because I didn't know if he had a gun or what would happen. So I wanted to see it, and I wanted to see it provided he was going to live. I was sort of praying, and I wanted to see it, but I didn't want a wild shot to come in my direction. I live on a street in New York where wild shots have sometimes come in people's directions.
Right.
So this was, and I had just come back to New York from the ocean where I'd been visiting a friend, so it all seemed very vivid to me.
Would you read the poem?
I'd be happy to. Summer Solstice, New York City. By the end of the longest day of the year, he could not stand it. He went up the iron stairs through the roof of the building and over the soft, tarry surface to the edge, put one leg over the complex green tin cornice, and said if they came a step closer, that was it. Then the huge machinery of the earth began to work for his life. The cops came in their suits, blue-gray as the sky on a cloudy evening, and one put on a bulletproof vest, a black shell around his own life, life of his children's father, in case the man was armed, and one, slung with a rope like the sign of his bounden duty, came up out of a hole in the top of the neighboring building, like the gold hole they say is in the top of the head, and began to lurk toward the man who wanted to die. The tallest cop approached him directly, softly, slowly, talking to him, talking, talking, while the man's leg hung over the lip of the next world, and the crowd gathered in the street, silent, and the hairy net with its implacable grid was unfolded near the curb and spread out and stretched as the sheet is prepared to receive at a birth. Then they all came a little closer, where he squatted next to his death, his shirt glowing its milky glow like something growing in a dish at night in the dark in a lab. And then everything stopped as his body jerked, and he stepped down from the parapet and went toward them, and they closed on him. I thought they were going to beat him up, as a mother whose child has been lost will scream at the child when it's found. They took him by the arms and held him up and leaned him against the wall of the chimney, and the tall cop lit a cigarette in his own mouth and gave it to him. And then they all lit cigarettes, and the red glowing ends burned like the tiny campfires we lit at night back at the beginning of the world.
I think that poem really gets a sense of how everyone feels very threatened by a suicide. Not threatened by the possibility of a stray shot headed toward them, but the fact that someone would want to take their life is a kind of threat to everybody else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To everybody else's equilibrium and sense of well-being.
Yes, I was talking to a class at NYU a while ago about endings of poems, and we all discovered together while working in the class that sometimes I would feel a poem didn't work at the end, but it was because I wanted a happy ending on the poem. And we decided to call me a salvation addict. So now that I read this to you, I hear, yes, it's definitely a poem of a salvation addict whose addiction is, whose craving is being satisfied for once by the event there on 97th Street.
Did you rewrite that poem a lot?
I didn't have to a lot. I always have to go back and take out adjectives, because I always put too many in, wanting to describe very precisely, but then it starts sounding so literary that I go back and take them out. But I remember the end was hard to get right. Those last four lines, I did over and over. I have maybe three or four pages in my ShopRite notebook with things written and crossed out, and then written and crossed out.
This poem that you just read is about something that you witnessed that obviously had a powerful effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of your poems are very personal, about your life, your upbringing, your parents, your children, your husband, your first lover, your best girlfriend who died when she was nine. They're very, very personal poems. And in a way, I think some of those poems are the kinds of thoughts you'd write in a diary that had a lock on it, and you'd keep that diary locked so no one else could see it.
Mm-hmm.
Did that ever bother you when you started writing poems, that you'd be writing a poem about your parents and they'd find it?
Well, what I look at in these poems, the way I look at any poems that I read or poems of young poets that I'm working with, they are poems as if to the parents of the speaker. I would never talk about them as poems about my parents, my husband, my children. I keep my private life very separate in my mind and in public from my life as a writer. So to me, there it's a speaker talking about parents. To me, that, and say I read someone else's poem and it's as if to their own parent. Does it matter to me if it was really to their own parent? No. What matters to me in their poem is if I feel that I'm present at a human experience that's being described in a way that feels real or useful or moving or visualizable to me. So that's a somewhat different take on the question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, with that said, would you read a poem for us called I Go Back to May, 1937?
Sure. I go back to May, 1937. I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks, with the wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips black in the May air. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They are kids. They are dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop. Don't do it. She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You are going to do bad things to children. You are going to suffer in ways you never heard of. You are going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it. Her hungry, pretty, blank face turning to me, her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. His arrogant, handsome face turning to me, his pitiful, beautiful, untouched body, but I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like the male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips like chips of flint as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it.
So is that poem about your parents, or do you prefer to think of it as a poem about somebody's parents, just a poem about parents but not necessarily yours?
Yes, it's similar with my own work as with work of others that I look at. The important thing to me for any of us is, I mean, you know, no one reads poetry. Almost no one reads it.
Right.
Everyone, almost, who hasn't written a poem at some time in their life, most people have written something. That need to speak is familiar to us all. But to read it, no. I don't know why, really. But if one were to be able to need to write poems that happen to seem as if they were by anybody or for anybody, or whose desire to share experience was such that the biographical side of it wasn't so interesting to readers as just the truth of it, or the apparent truth, or just if it felt like anybody, like a real person.
I'm trying to figure out if this poem and the other very personal poems like it are really very personal to you, but you'd rather just not talk about the personal experiences that they came from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
Could you talk a little about that desire of yours, about where it comes from or what the meaning of that is? Why want to know as a reader?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. And when I was reading your poems last night and thinking about what we were going to talk about in the interview, I was thinking, well, really, what makes Sharon Olds interesting to me? Do I really care what her parents were like, or do I really care that she writes good poetry? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I really care that she writes good poetry. But then I said, but I'm also interested in the parts of her life that inspired the poems mm-hmm. that she writes about, and how those experiences helped her become the poet she is today.
Mm-hmm. I've had a very interesting experience in teaching, in that by the end of a semester, and I've spoken, you know, in private to all the students in the workshop, and I taught two workshops one semester, and they at two different schools, and by the end of the semester, every woman writer in the workshops had asked me questions about privacy. Who to show the work to, who to stop showing it to, mm-hmm. what the mother felt about it, what the lover had said, whether they were having writing block problems because of that. And none of the men. It was like perfect record. Oh, you know, 0, 16 or something. Had asked me those questions. And it wasn't that I wasn't close to them. We were writers working together on poems. We were very close to each other. But for the women, it was a very important issue. And I know that among men poets whom I know who have written about family, I say to them, well, what do you say when you're asked about your specific, you know, child or parent? And they say, well, I'm not asked that much. So I don't know if we if part of what you and I are participating in here mm-hmm. at this moment has to do with women having traditionally been, what can I say, like vessels of feeling, the hearts, you know, in the body politic, and that if they are speaking about actual family members, it's somehow more, I don't know if it's scary, you know, or interesting or what. I've gone through a whole history of thinking and feeling about all of this. You know, this is at the end of, I've just given my fourth book to my editor, so when I first started out, I didn't know what I thought about all of this. So mm-hmm. if you had asked me this question 10 years ago, I would have probably given a very different answer. But I've come to not worry about these questions or be interested in them in the same way. And also for writers that I'm working with, if they're writing about something merely because it's true or because they have a strong feeling about it, you know, as a poem, it's not necessarily going to work. It has to jump the fence somehow, just, or knock it down. And the poem has to be free to lead its own life.
Mm-hmm. So you don't like talking about your own life, but just the life of the poems.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Now, here's one thing I would wonder. One of the emotions that you express in the poem that you just read is the sense of, like, knowing that these two people who will become your parents are not fated to love each other for very long, and you'd really like to go back and make them stop that relationship, but it would mean that you would not be born. I think this is probably an emotion that a lot of people have had. And that probably a lot of people have tried to control. Do you know, there's a lot of thoughts that come to your mind and you think, I shouldn't be thinking this. This is really bad to think.
Yeah.
I think what a poet would do would be to confront the thought and write a poem about it, as opposed to trying to repress the thought.
Yes, that must be one of the uses of poetry in our time, besides the singing of language itself without melody. It seems to me both of those impulses are probably equally strong in the poems that I read that I like the most. It's hard to know what the function of poetry is in our society. I mean, sometimes one feels it's so tiny. But I think you're right that desire to say what hasn't been said, to have, to make an object or a little being on the page, like the poem, you know, the way it sits there with its body on the page, to give that less often mentioned thought or feeling from inside the person. Yeah, I like your idea. That rings a bell for me. Yeah.
When did you start to write?
Well, I wrote as a kid, and I wrote as a teenager, and then I wrote fiction in college. Terrible. Trash in college. And somehow for me, working with the line, working with a small shaped form, helped me some with my problems of sentimentality and the adjective. I guess it's partly that my desire to find the shape of something soon, right, rather than in a novel where I guess I just don't know what they do, but I mean, they must have an enormous long-range sense of shape. But I don't. I'm less patient, and my eagerness to get the poem out of my mind, out of my body in a sense, on the page, to make more room, kind of more air inside of me, just ordinary air to breathe and lead a life kind of unburdened by the as yet unshaped realization of that kind of little thought that you mentioned that you have in your mind sometimes that you brush aside, but instead of brushing it aside, to realize it and get it out. And then there's a little free space, you know, a little park in there instead.
The poem that you just read, I go back to May 1937 about the parents. The last line in the poem is, "Do what you're going to do, and I will tell about it." Have you found in your life that telling about things, that making poems about things, gives you a certain power? Because finally, no matter what anyone has said or done to you or done in your presence, you have the power to tell it the way you perceive it and to give it its final interpretation, at least in your mind and in the life of that poem.
That's nice. I bet that's a strong unconscious involvement of mine in poetry. It's not very conscious. I mean, what I would perceive more is the pleasure of playing with language, the relief of speaking, the satisfaction of feeling the line turn at the end and come back to the left-hand margin, that kind of dance, that kind of physical dance of the poem. Sure, I bet a lot of it has to do with power. Consciously, no. A poet is not likely to feel powerful. I don't think. It's not as bad a danger for us, but I'm sure that that's a satisfaction of it that I'm usually not conscious of, but that's there.
My guest is poet Sharon Olds. Her second book, The Dead and the Living, won a 1985 National Book Critics Circle Award. Her latest collection of poems is titled The Gold Cell. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Can we go back? back to your students for a second? When you talk to the women students who you teach and go over with them the question of privacy and personal life, what advice do you give them?
Well, I say that that it's individual. There's no rule. At different times in our life, with different people in our life, it's the right thing to do to be more or less open. I talk about what I call the spectrum of loyalty and betrayal. On one end of it, being saying everything, naming names. You know, reading, hearing your friend talk to you about their intimate life, writing a poem about it with all the names, dates, and times, and publishing it. I mean, there we're over by betrayal, a kind of almost a very destructive impulse, I would say. So over at the other side, you would have someone who is so loyal that they don't even write the poem about the person.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that they write it and don't publish it, they don't even write it. And then you go even further over and they don't even think the thought. And then you go all the way over to that and you have a self-destructiveness that's very extreme. Now, of course, most of the transactions about loyalty and betrayal and art occur close to the middle. But I try to lay it out for them and I try to say that I can't tell them what they should do. I've made mistakes. You just try to do the right thing by the living people and, you know, the dead and the possible readers. I mean, by the human in its large self and in its small specific selves that you know.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Sure.
And this is from an earlier volume of poems called The Dead and the Living. And the poem I'll ask you to read is called New Mother.
Yes. New Mother. A week after our child was born, you cornered me in the spare room and we sank down on the bed. You kissed me and kissed me. My milk undid its burning slipknot through my nipples, soaking my shirt. All week I had smelled of milk, fresh milk, sour. I began to throb. My sex had been torn easily as cloth by the crown of her head. I'd been cut with a knife and sewn, the stitches pulling at my skin. And the first time you're broken, you don't know you'll be healed again, better than before. I lay in fear and blood and milk while you kissed and kissed me, your lips hot and swollen as a teenage boy's, your sex dry and big, all of you so tender. You hung over me, over the nest of the stitches, over the splitting and tearing, with the patience of someone who finds a wounded animal in the woods and stays with it, not leaving its side until it is whole, until it can run again.
That's a beautiful poem. Do you remember writing the poem?
No. This is a long time ago now.
So is it like a found poem to you?
Do
you not remember it at all?
It was. Yeah.
And what did you think about when you read it?
You have great hearing. I thought I liked it. I liked the ending. When it came to the wounded animal, I was sort of rewriting there. I thought, oh, that's a little corny. And then when it came to the kissed and kissed, I've been writing so much love poetry. I'd say this poem is maybe 10 years old. I've been writing lots of love poems in the last, 5 years, 2 years, a year. And I was just looking to see how guarded this was, how much it was going to keep itself to, how shy it was. And I thought it was rather shy.
Oh, it kind of needed to be shy in that sense, though, because
the
mother's so vulnerable in it. I mean, it can't be a sexual poem in that respect. I mean,
right. Yeah, that's right.
So how come you're writing a lot of love poems now?
I don't know. What a good question. Part of it, I think... sometimes when people say, how difficult to be a woman poet... I think of all the poems, however, that haven't been written because most of the poets weren't women. So that is poems that are written from, or as if from, personal experience. So that to be able to, I mean, it's exciting to an artist to want and need to be writing about something that hasn't already been done a lot. So being a woman is a wonderful thing in that way, and especially with love poetry and erotic poetry, so little of it has been written by women or by men. So I guess once I started noticing that I was liking writing that, then the fact that it hadn't been done a huge amount was also, I guess, kind of, oh, exciting or reassuring to me, as if I wasn't just doing the same thing. That's very exciting, that sense that you might be doing something that you haven't done over and over again, or someone else hasn't done over and over again.
You know, there is a song, I think it's an Ira Gershwin lyric, that goes, what can you say in a love song that's never been said before?
Mm.
I think that's the problem, really, that a lot of love poetry is up against, that there's actually been so much of it, in spite of what you're saying.
Well, I think you're right. In any poetry about happiness, we talk about this in class a lot. Why are the poems about grief better poems, mostly?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we write about our joy? And certainly what I see in the progression of my books is not so much the ones that have already come out as the ones that are waiting in the wings, that are written but not out as books yet, is a progression in that direction towards, many, many more poems of joy.
Can I ask you to read one more poem?
Sure.
It's called The Pope's Penis.
Yes.
Okay, why don't you read the poem and then I'll ask you about it.
Okay. The Pope's Penis. It hangs deep in his robes, a delicate clapper at the center of a bell. It moves when he moves, a ghostly fish in a halo of silver seaweed, the hair swaying in the dark and the heat. And at night, while his eyes sleep, it stands up in praise of God.
I think you've really written about the subject that absolutely nobody is supposed to ever think about.
Right. Well, that's so... It's exciting. It makes you happy to think about and write about something that you're absolutely not supposed to. If you're a defiant person who has joy in defiance, and this I wrote this when this was first Pope, before I knew what was going to happen in terms of the Vatican's feelings about women's bodies and the use of them and their privacy and whose business it is to decide what and think what about women. It really wasn't consciously a political poem. I thought he was cute. And I really do have a feeling that we shouldn't ask each other to not speak. I really have that feeling that whatever you want to say about my poems, I shouldn't say to you, oh, don't say that, or please say what I want to hear. I really think we shouldn't do that with each other, and that the poets should say whatever they think, whatever comes into their mind, and then should play with it. Also, playing with the language.
The biggest problem is sometimes self-censorship.
Right. Right. Yes, yeah, so defiance helps.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with us and reading some of your poems.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you, Terry.
Sharon Old's latest collection of poems is titled The Gold Cell. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Newsweek correspondent Sylvester Monroe. He recently returned to the ghetto housing project where he grew up for a reunion with his boyhood friends. Their successful and failed attempts to get out of the ghetto are chronicled in his new book, Brothers. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On October 22, 1986, Paul Monette's beloved friend died of AIDS. Monette fears we're losing a generation of gay men to the epidemic. Coming up, we discuss his memoir, Borrowed Time, about witnessing his lover's death. At the turn of the century, Alexander Zemlinsky was one of the top conductors and composers in Vienna. Now some of his original 78s have been reissued. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And did you know the dictionary wasn't always in alphabetical order? Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explains why and when we made the big switch. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
Are selected to investigate charges of wrongdoing by high-ranking administration appointees. Details from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
The court's ruling is a major defeat for the Reagan administration, which had argued that the special prosecutor's law unconstitutionally takes away the president's power to appoint, control, and remove prosecutors. But the Supreme Court totally rejected that argument in an opinion written by the man President Reagan appointed as Chief Justice, William Rehnquist. The court's decision sweeps aside constitutional clouds that had lingered over other special prosecutors and dispels doubts about the convictions of former White House aides Michael Deaver and Lynn Nofziger. Deaver's sentencing, which had been postponed pending the outcome of today's case, will now be rescheduled. Moreover, two other special prosecutors, the Iran-Contra prosecutor and the prosecutor looking into Attorney General Meese's affairs, can now continue their probes without concern over their status. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
It was Soviet leader Gorbachev's turn to listen today as delegates took the floor at a special Communist Party conference in Moscow. Yesterday, Gorbachev outlined proposals to restructure the Soviet government and reduce some of the party's power over day-to-day economic and social life. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Party members who've gathered from all over the Soviet Union demanded greater economic change and complained about government bureaucracy. But they had little to say about Gorbachev's political reforms. A few agreed that elected officials should serve limited terms, no more than 10 or 15 years. But no one ventured an opinion about Gorbachev's call for a new Soviet president. This is not necessarily bad news for Gorbachev. Instead, it indicates that the delegates are probably ready to defer to their leader and give him the endorsement he seeks when they're asked to vote on political change later this week. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The House Armed Services Committee today opened its hearings on defense procurement practices amid charges that tens of billions of dollars were wasted as a result of fraud and bribery by defense contractors. NPR's David Molpus reports that the Pentagon's chief purchasing official today defended the system.
The Undersecretary of Defense, who oversees Pentagon weapons buying, said, "Our acquisition system works." Robert Costello said reforms adopted during the Reagan administration have made the process more competitive, and that those who monitor contracts are getting more effective at catching crooks. Committee member Patricia Schroeder showed her impatience, saying, "You drive me crazy. You're in a protective mode." And committee chairman Les Aspin asked Costello why the scandal was breaking now if the system was working so well.
One word, greed.
It's personal. Greed is not invented in the 1980s. No. We had greed in the 1970s and 1960s.
I just don't think we worked hard enough to uncover it before.
Costello also attributed the scandal to a changed ethical climate. "We don't tolerate things today that we did 20 years ago." Also, he said, military contracts are larger now, creating more pressure on industry to get an inside track. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Two U.S. F-16 jet fighters collided today in Frankfurt, West Germany. One pilot was killed, the other was injured. Another F-16 crashed in a separate accident near Stuttgart. There were no injuries in that crash. 21 U.S. F-16s have now crashed since the plane arrived in Europe in 1981. The German defense minister has asked the U.S. Air Force to temporarily halt F-16 flights. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped almost 9 points to close at 2121.98. Declines led advances 3-2 on volume of 159 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new compilation of some rare early recordings by the Austrian conductor Alexander Zemlinsky. Zemlinsky was admired as a composer and conductor in his homeland, but died in this country in 1942, virtually unknown. But now Zemlinsky's music is being rediscovered.
Alexander Zemlinsky is not a household name in this country. But in Vienna at the turn of the century, there were few musicians who were more respected. He was Schoenberg's teacher and brother-in-law, and had a tremendous influence on the composers of the so-called Viennese school. He was especially admired as a conductor, but there's been very little hard evidence for his high reputation. One of the few subjects musicians as opinionated as Schoenberg and Stravinsky ever agreed about. Now the Schwann label has released an album of Zemlinsky's recordings made with the Berlin Philharmonic and other Berlin orchestras between 1928 and 1930. There's no Mahler, no Berg, Schoenberg, or Webern, and no Zemlinsky. He apparently never recorded any of the music he was most closely associated with. The album includes 9 short selections, overtures by Mozart, Beethoven, Rossini, von Flotow, and Mayr, as well as that pop's perennial, the polka from Weinberger's Schwanda, the bagpiper. The longest piece is Smetana's nationalistic tone poem, The Moldau. Listen to how buoyantly that river ripples through the Czech countryside. Some of these performances, however, may take a little getting used to. The sound of the old 78s is about as far as you can get from hi-fi, though sound specialist Barton Wimble has done a superb job with the transfers. Still, the performances themselves may seem a little rough-edged at first, even a little tame, but the more you listen, the more engrossing they become. Zemlinsky is not a modern conductor. He has a fundamentally 19th-century attitude, a freedom with tempo more radical than almost anything we'd hear in classical music today. His method is to heighten expression by holding a note longer than it's written. This is a tradition of not doing exactly what a score demands. Time stops. The music floats. Every moment contains an emotional vignette. The term for this technique is rubato, which means robbed. It's as if these extra suspended seconds are stolen from the designated time. This technique died because it encouraged sloppiness and sentimentality. Yet Zemlinsky managed to modify the strict tempo without losing the meter, the overall momentum or shape of a piece. What the liner notes call his metrical rubato is not so much a contradiction in terms as a version of the individuality with which every great musician makes phrases. The irony is that now this tradition is more respectable in jazz than in classical music. But the clock of styles comes full circle. In the concert hall today, Zemlinsky's conservatism would sound very daring. Of course, it's unlikely that every 19th century conductor could have held a piece together as beautifully as Zemlinsky does, or could have been as tasteful or subtle or charming as he is here, or as modern.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Alexander Zemlinsky Conducts on the Schwann label. This is Fresh Air. While his lover was dying of AIDS, novelist and poet Paul Manette's greatest fear was that he too would get sick and the two of them would die apart in separate hospital rooms. But that didn't happen. But Roger Horowitz died on October 22, 1986. Paul Manette took care of Roger during his 19-month-long struggle with AIDS. Manette has recorded his feelings about their 12-year relationship and its premature end in his new book, Borrowed Time. Here's Paul Manette reading from the opening of Borrowed Time.
I don't know if I will live to finish this. Doubtless there is a streak of self-importance in such an assertion, but who's counting? Maybe it's just that I've watched too many sicken in a month and die by Christmas, so that a fatal sort of realism comforts me more than magic. All I know is this: the virus ticks in me, and it doesn't care a whit about our categories. When is full-blown? What's AIDS-related? What is just sick and tired? No one has solved the puzzle of its timing. I take my drug from Tijuana twice a day. The very friends who tell me how vigorous I look, how well I seem, are the first to assure me of the imminent medical breakthrough. What they don't seem to understand is I used up all my optimism keeping my friend alive. Now that he's gone, the cup of my own health is neither half full nor half empty, just half.
Paul, how did you start writing this memoir?
The night that Roger died, I turned to his doctor and said, what am I going to do without him? And he said to me, you have to write about him, Paul. And I'd been saying to Roger for weeks before that, I'm never going to write again, I'm never going to write again. But something about the doctor giving me that command made sense and struck flint.
You know, I was reading The Village Voice a few days ago, and the writer Armistead Maupin was quoted as saying, I'm reading Paul Monette's book Borrowed Time right now, and the single experience that you have when you read it is to say yes, 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 three times on every page. That's the real function of gay literature right now. Do you agree with that, that that's the function of gay literature now, that, that yes, 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 that you'd experience reading?
I hope what Armistead is talking about has something to do with the pitch of rage and the pitch of love that are in the book. I wrote the book in a kind of fury and as nakedly as I could. I mean, what I would say to myself every morning, Terry, was, how can I be even more honest? How can I be? I just would beat myself up to be as honest as I could mm-hmm. about everything that I'd felt. And I guess I certainly believe that gay people have got to stand witness to this calamity every day of their lives. So we somehow have to make a testament that will make our readers, that will make our people cry out that way. Yes, you've got it right.
You know, reading your book, I get the sense that in the last more than a year that you spent together with Roger, that you were especially frustrated that you couldn't be legally married.
I'm not sure that the contract would have been so important to me, Terry, but I think my frustration was more irrational than that. It had to do with a kind of a sense of devastation that because we were assaulted by this disease, which was the cause of so much hatred and fear and meanness out there, that somehow it would be the whole love that we'd had for each other for 12 years, the kind of triumph we'd felt in being so close and so twinned, would be lost, that we would just be one more cold-blooded statistic on the wrong page of the almanac.
Did that end up being a problem, or did you feel that that commitment and love weren't recognized by the people who really mattered?
Good point. And there's no question but that we were surrounded by waves of love from our families and our friends, that they really stood in the fire with us during all of that terrible last year. I also feel that having written it down, having somehow recorded our love within the calamity, I haven't lost us. We haven't been lost. I don't want... Every week or so, someone I know dies. And every week or 2 weeks, someone I know goes into the hospital and ends up with a diagnosis. And my friends and I are always saying we must not see them in the mass. We have to still see each person uniquely as himself. It's difficult because there's such a holocaust going on around us.
In your book, you write that you went through a period of really not wanting to talk to people who didn't have AIDS, and I'd like to know why you went through that period and if you're still in that.
It's a good remark to pick up on because I know so many people who say it back to me. I feel in a way that there was a kind of madness about that feeling, but it was a feeling that I had in the summer of 85, about 6 months after Roger was diagnosed, and when three or four people very, very close to me had AIDS and were fighting so hard to get, you know, some kind of medication online, we knew that the Reagan administration was paying no attention, that the medical bureaucracy was mired in red tape. We knew nobody cared. And that sense of rage that came from nobody caring made me feel that all my valuable time was spent in talking to other people caught in the nightmare, that if we talked about it and confronted it one with another as much as we could, we would form a kind of AIDS underground and we would find the way out of the nightmare. I don't now feel quite so much that they're the only people that I can talk to. I feel actually I need myself these days to reach out and to try to make more people understand it. But I thoroughly understand how terrible it is to feel like you're living in the Warsaw Ghetto and a lot of the rest of the world looks like it's going to the opera in Berlin.
Now, you test seropositive now, which means you test positive for exposure to the HIV virus, but you don't have AIDS.
That's correct, and it's an important distinction to make, although even people who read my book with and like it a lot have gone to press saying that I do have AIDS. It's an important distinction to make because we have to understand how many seropositive people there are out there who are not showing symptoms. To meet me, I look fine, and I feel fine. I am trying to intervene with antiviral medication, and I am very activist about that, so I'm taking a bunch of antiviral drugs, and in the hopes that I can hold back full-blown symptoms. The glimmer, the light at the end of the tunnel here is that we hope to have a pharmaceutical online soon enough that can turn this disease from being a fatal illness into being a chronic illness.
Well, yet you wrote that you felt you'd used up all your optimism on Roger. I guess that's not completely true, that you still have optimism left.
I certainly have optimism for other people, and fighting for other people seems to mean a great deal to me. On a good day, I don't feel like I'm dying. On a bad day, that matter is kind of irrelevant. I expect I will die of AIDS one day. I hope it's going to be pretty far down the line, though. If we can get antiviral medication that works, it may well be 5 or 10 or 20 years before it affects me.
You know, I'll tell you one of the things that I thought when I was reading your book. You know, as Roger was dying, as you were going through just a terrible period, you had to make a living, and you were writing screenplays that are getting turned down, and TV scripts that are getting turned down, and you wrote a couple of novelizations. And during this period, you wrote the novelization of the film Predator. And I was thinking, now, if I had read the novelization of the film Predator, would I have, as I was reading this, thought that the person who wrote this was going through what you were going through? It just made me think so much of the things we don't know about people when we read their books.
Curiously, if you were to read it now, it's not very good. But if you were to read it, if you were to read it right now, you would in fact see certain passages where the alien is in the jungle that are clearly quite AIDS-related. When I talk about the violence and the alien going after people and the kind of the rot of the jungle, there's no question where that metaphor is coming from. I'd rather people read Borrowed Time, though.
Okay, Paul. I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate it.
Paul Monette is the author of Borrowed Time, an AIDS memoir. His most recent collection of poetry, also published this year, is called Love Alone, 18 Elegies for Raj. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's up?
Well, the Supreme Court today released a number of major end-of-the-term decisions. We'll have several reports, among them one from Nina Totenberg about the court's ruling upholding the special prosecutor law, the whole idea of an independent counsel who doesn't report to the Attorney General. Also, a profile of a Kentucky coal baron, a man who's engaged in strip mining, by Frank Browning. And we have a report on a new Euro jazz quartet. It's the best word I can come up with to describe them. They're called Film Noir, and they're now based in Dallas, but they come from all over.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This time of year, dictionaries and thesauruses are popular graduation gifts. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on these two kinds of reference books.
Books of words are almost as old as writing itself. But for most of history, they've been organized thematically, which is to say, according to the nature of things, rather than the spellings of words. The 9th century encyclopedia of the Islamic scholar Ibn Qatayba contained 10 sections on power, war, nobility, character, eloquence, asceticism, friendship, prayers, food, and women. 2 centuries later, the Anglo-Saxon abbot Elfrich divided his vocabulary into 20 chapters, beginning with words for God in the heavens, and so on down through the names of weapons, parts of a city, and precious stones. This thematic system was swept away around the beginning of the 17th century with a sudden, widespread adoption of the principle of alphabetical order. Nobody's sure why the change occurred just then. The alphabetical system had actually been around for some time, but it was rarely used. Some scholars have suggested that the change had to do with the development of movable type, as printers became accustomed to shuffling the letters of the alphabet around in trays. But it's more likely that the change reflected a new conception of the nature of language. All at once, the structure of language was peeled away from the structure of the world and made arbitrary and senseless. Now you found armadillo listed between armada and Armageddon. Yet the thematic system was to have one last hurrah in 1852, when the Thesaurus of English Words and Phrases was published by the remarkable English physician and scientist Peter Marc Roget. Roget compiled his thesaurus with a grandiose intention to provide a universal scheme for the classification of all words and things. The book is divided into 10 major classes, which are further divided into sections, subsections, and ultimately into exactly 1,000 basic headings. For example, the words mass, bulk, and corpulence are listed under the heading breadth and thickness in the subsection linear dimensions in the section dimensions of the general class space. Roget's thesaurus was one of the most ambitious intellectual undertakings of the 19th century. Yet today, we tend to regard the book as primarily a synonym finder for writing and crossword puzzle solving. We do most of our searching in the alphabetical index at the back of the book, which Roget added only as an afterthought. In fact, several publishers have come out with books called Roget's Thesaurus, where the listing of words is entirely alphabetical and no trace is left of Roget's original thematic organization. Why this preference for alphabetical order? It's not that the alphabetical system is intrinsically more efficient than the system of thematic organization that Roget used. For one thing, the alphabetic system is useless when you don't know in advance what word you're looking for. Out of scientific curiosity, I once watched an Englishman spend half an hour poring over the yellow pages to find a place that sold hibachis before I took pity on him and sent him out to a nearby drugstore. And you'll get no help from an alphabetical dictionary if you're looking for the word that refers to the pointy end of a boat. The great virtue of the alphabetical system is its philosophical modesty. It doesn't require the writer to find a single system of classification for all experience, nor does it require the reader to learn one. If you like, the alphabetical system is more democratic. In fact, it's often used as a way of concealing the intrinsic order among things. When you list the donors to a museum wing or the guest stars on an episode of Murder, She Wrote alphabetically, you don't have to worry about who gets top billing. Alphabetical order is the appropriate scheme for a secular world where, as the French writer Michel Foucault put it, language has withdrawn from the midst of things.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. ABC. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with horror writer Patrick McGrath. It's a genre that comes easy to him. He grew up on the grounds of an English asylum for the criminally insane. Also, there's a new album by James Brown, the self-proclaimed godfather of soul. Rock critic Ken Tucker will have a review. And Stephen Schiff will look at Coming to America, the new Eddie Murphy film that co-stars Arsenio Hall. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Deirdre Danzing. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.